The godfather of soul, James Brown, liked to be introduced on stage as the hardest working man in showbiz. And if you were ever lucky enough to see him live, which I was, I'm pleased to say, then you would have to concede he had a point. But Samuel L. Jackson, whom I'm chatting with today, is certainly a contender to take over that title. He's getting close to having appeared in 200 movies, which is remarkable. Some are great, of course, game changers, memorable, of course, I'm going to Pulp Fiction here in particular. Many are very good. A few were terrible, but he is consistently exciting to watch. There's a magnetism and power and charisma he brings to every performance that is unmistakably his, which helps explain why he's generally considered to be the highest grossing actor of all time. Films that he's appeared in having made around $5.8 billion. So let's not waste any of his eye-wateringly valuable time. Here he is, Samuel L. Jackson. And by the way, I'm going to start by referring to a Super Bowl commercial that he didn't actually appear in, that Lawrence Fishburne made, but there was some idiot on American TV who was interviewing Sam Jackson and said, "So what about that Super Bowl commercial?" Let's see how that plays. Did you get a lot of reaction to that Super Bowl commercial?
Here we go again. Well, Sam will be happy that you remembered that.
I love that.
He's so.
I love the way you went for that guy afterwards. It was so much fun. But you don't.
He was a victim of me being in a studio alone for a few hours, and I was bored by the time he asked me that question. It's kind of like, okay, this will be a bit of fun.
It was also a dumb question and an act of casual racism, which I'm sure you've encountered a lot in your life.
Of course.
Yeah. So we'll move on from the Super Bowl. You're in town for Glass.
Yes.
When you made Unbreakable, which I loved, was there any inkling, did Mr. Shyamalan give you any idea that you were thinking of a trilogy? Did he have any idea of that, or was it a surprise to you?
No, that's what he told us.
At the time?
When we started doing it, he said, yeah, this is the first of three films.
Amazing.
So I figured, well, okay, the next film will be, I guess, me breaking out of this mental institution or whatever and catching up with David Dunn, wherever he is. But as the years went by, I go, did he forget, or did they really think that that movie was not as successful as it needed to be to make another one, you know, which was sort of like the idea for a while by the powers that be, I guess because it didn't make as much money as I See Dead People.
But it was still a hit, though, wasn't it?
It was. In my mind, it was.
I think it was.
But because it didn't surpass that first figure,
you
know, they actually allowed him the unusual quirk of shooting that film in sequence. So even though I only worked 13 days on Unbreakable, I was in Philadelphia like 2.5 months.
Presumably you're filling that time with a lot of golf.
I was.
Yeah. So it's a pleasant experience.
It was fine for me.
Yeah.
I didn't care.
You don't seem, do you get stressed by changes in schedules and by people messing you around, or does that not happen anymore?
Well, it's a movie. So movies are, you know, shifting, ever-changing animals. So you don't make plans around them other than the specific amount of time that you're supposed to be there. And then when they go over, you can see sometimes, well, if you've been on enough movie sets, you'll start to see, okay, we're not making our days and we're going to go over and, okay, we're going to have to come back and do reshoots because this particular thing here is not working, but they got to move on. So you kind of figure it all out so you don't get stressed by it.
Yeah. But is there, it must be, I would imagine, there must be times when, you have to manage what could be a stressful situation.
Of course.
What I'm getting at here is, do you get angry ever? Because I know on the screen you channel a certain anger, and there have been things in your life and in every African-American's life which has caused much anger. And I wonder whether you use that or whether you can control that always.
Control it, because it has nothing to do with what the process is. There are times, you know, when you and the creative powers that be don't, you know, see eye to eye, or you're not getting along for whatever reason. But you try and continue to be professional and get it done, because movies are pretty much a collaborative thing. And interestingly enough, there are a lot of moving parts, and all those other people standing around doing their jobs are a lot harder than mine. They're moving stuff. They're picking up things. They got to make adjustments. They got to do it. So you want to be as efficient as you can possibly be so that those people don't get burned out and worn out. Because, at the end of everything, you're almost the least important cog in that machine. You're up there on screen, but, if the lighting guy doesn't get the lights right, they're not going to see you. If the sound guy doesn't get the sound right, they're not going to hear you. If, the grips don't move the cameras, or, the dolly grip's not able to do, then all kinds of things can happen that cause disarray.
Was this an awareness you always had? Because when you first started in movies, did you think, no, I am the most important cog in this machine? Or have you always had that approach?
I figured that out early. I was fortunate enough to be a photo double on a couple films before I actually started, you know, getting film jobs. So I knew what it meant to be that person to stand in this particular place or to hit that mark so that they can get it, so that everything works right when the right person is there doing it. Also discovered too that the majority of the time the director is the person that spent the least amount of time on a film set.
Yeah.
Everybody else has worked on like 50 movies, director's done 3.
Yeah.
You know, it's that.
Yeah. And so the director can sometimes be the person who needs to be kept an eye on the most, I guess.
Right, who needs to listen to everybody else that's around in terms of what's going on and how it's supposed to work.
You said everyone's got a tougher job than you, and especially in Glass, because you're not only you're not on screen, but you're sitting down the whole time. I mean, this is a lazy approach to your career right now. Is this the way forward? We got always see you in chairs from now on?
I'm in a wheelchair. I'm doing a lot of wheeling.
A little bit. No, you get pushed a lot of that movie.
Oh, I get pushed a bit. But, you know, I find myself getting wheeled around a lot, you know, when I was alone and being Elijah undercover. You know,
I love Mr. Glass. I love the hair as well. I mean, the wigs have been a kind of a constant source of joy.
Always.
To me and the audience, and perhaps to you to wear them as well. How much input do you have? Because you do have a big say on those things, don't you?
Yeah. I talk about who I am and how I want to look. But, you know, when we did... Unbreakable, Knight had already figured that was the way he wanted him to look, which was great. You know, I like a lot of hair.
Yeah.
So that whole Frederick Douglass hairstyle for Unbreakable works out, you know, in a really great way.
And the suit in the new one, is that Prince or Channing there or Rick James?
It's the same thing I had on in Unbreakable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's more or less the same thing. Did you have the monogram cravat in the first film as well?
I don't know that I had that.
No, I don't think you did.
Yeah.
I was wondering who made that while you were in the mental institution. Your mom was
my
busy.
Mom. Yeah. She was, you know, she brought me the nice slippers and the nice MG slippers because they have Mr. Glass. They have MG on them also.
Do you keep any of the stuff from your films? Do you have any of that stuff to wear?
I have one of the glass canes from the first film.
That's a good thing to
keep. Yeah, good prop.
Yeah. Working with Bruce Willis again, that must be nice because you've been friends now for quite a while, haven't
you? Yeah.
Was it Pulp Fiction you met on?
No, we met when I met Bruce on National Lampoon's Loaded Weapon.
Wow.
His brother was one of the producers, and he did a cameo one day.
Wow.
And that was the first time I met him.
That's going way back.
Yeah.
Let's go even further back. Were you the Sugar Plum Fairy? Is that correct, when you were 3?
Yeah.
Man, it doesn't seem like a natural fit to me, but I mean...
My aunt, she was doing things, and she never had enough boys. I lived in the house with her, so... Kind of like, this is what you're going to do now.
And
so.
You've got memories of that. You can actually remember doing that.
Yeah.
Wow. What do you remember?
The thing that makes you want to keep doing it, you know, when the show is over and people come up to you and they pinch you on the cheek and go, oh my God, you're so cute. Yeah. And you remember, you always remember that. You know, it's like, okay, this is good.
And I suppose in a way, you kind of get that sort of feedback still today, just not quite as physical.
Well, I get it when I go to the bank.
Yeah.
And I put money in there and they go, oh, it's you, hey!
You know, what's remarkable, I mean, your career is obviously amazing and a huge success you've had. And it strikes me that, you know, some people would slow down. Some people would stop working as much as you seem to work. And I know that you work on your own terms to a certain extent, but what is it that keeps you engaged? Why do you want to keep getting up early and going to film sets?
Great place to hang out. Gives me an opportunity to not be me. On a, you know, constant basis to tell a story, be a part of it. You know, like I say to people, painters get up and paint, writers get up and write. You know, why can't I get up and act?
Yeah.
When I was a young actor, that was all I thought about was, you know, getting a job. And some days the only acting opportunity you had was to go to an audition, you know, to show off for somebody.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I try and find as many acting opportunities as I can to, you know, do what I want to do because life is a lot shorter than people think.
Yeah.
You know, and there are only a limited number of opportunities to do the thing that you do. So I like to get out there and do it.
Keep doing it.
Yeah.
You said an opportunity to be someone other than yourself. I'm assuming that isn't because you're unhappy being yourself. I'm assuming that's just fun to play.
No, not at all. It's just, you know, part and parcel of saying to yourself, well, I want to try something new today, or I'm going to have an experience that allows me to, you know, do this thing that I wouldn't normally do in my life, which is kind of great.
Yeah. Who's the character that's been most close to you in real life, though, on screen?
Probably Zeus Carver in Die Hard.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So he was a kind of intelligent man, a man who, yeah, he was kind of an open, he knew how to sort of play the kind of opportunities as well,
yeah,
didn't he?
Pro-black with a, you know, smart mouth and intelligent enough, you know, to be and hanging black. Out.
But not Farrakhan, Nation of Islam.
Right, no.
Yeah.
But, you know, hanging out with John McClane. My job in that movie basically was to be an audience member running around the streets of New York with John McClane.
Yeah.
Which is kind of great.
Yeah. You know. I've read up on you this, which I haven't done quite as extensively before when we've met, because normally we'd be doing more, you know, just I was amazed to read that you were an usher at Dr. Martin Luther King's funeral service.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't know that. Nice. I guess that was one of, but an amazing time in history, a terrible time in history.
Mm.
Things haven't changed as much as we thought
as
they might.
As much as we think. Yeah.
When you look back to that period, what was the young Samuel Jackson like?
I guess, well, working on change, knowing who I was and what I wanted to do, and the creative aspect of me was one person, and my politics were, you know, about change, you know, sort of anti-war, working through the civil rights movement at the time and what all that meant in terms of, Dr. King's nonviolence as opposed to Rap Brown, Stokely Carmichael's violence is as American as, you know, apple pie, and finding my place in that and not necessarily thinking of my own safety and thinking of the good of society and what a better place it would be if specific things were in place or were happening. And those things, you know, kind of happened, kind of changed. You know, change came. And as much as change came, you know, people kind of frosted it over with something else. And you look up, you know, 50 years later, and it's almost like we're going backward. Yeah, it's crazy.
Which brings us to your old golfing buddy, Donald Trump.
Mm.
Okay, we don't have to talk about him, but you used to play golf with him a lot, didn't you?
No, not a lot.
Did he genuinely cheat
just
when he played
enough.
Did he cheat when he played golf with you?
He cheats when he plays with everybody, I'm sure.
Well, let's hope things change.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're going to change. Everything changes. That's one thing you learn as you get older. I want to ask you a little bit about being married for how many years now?
38, but we lived together 10 years before we got married.
Okay, so you've been together for nearly 50 years.
Almost 50 years.
Wow, that's incredible. I read an interview. It was an interview with you, but the journalist spoke to your wife and asked to what she thought you could attribute the endurance of this relationship, and she said amnesia.
Yeah, right. There's that. Yeah.
Well, is that you comfortable with her saying that?
Of course, yeah. I mean, she wasn't just talking about, you know, forgetting about things that I've done, but me forgetting about things that she's done also.
Oh, I
see.
Know?
Yeah, it's a two-way street.
Nice turnaround there.
Yeah,
nice
it's a two-way street.
What are the kind of fun roles for you to tackle now? Because I read that when you were younger, you looked forward to doing and playing the kind of characters that had entertained you as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
When you sat in that cinema and you'd see Errol Flynn, all these guys, you kind of have done almost every kind of movie, I guess.
I've gotten around to it, yeah. Pretty much, yeah, a lot of that stuff. I read stories that, you know, make me laugh. I read stories that are exciting, and those are the things I want to do. I like popcorn movies now. I mean, I used to think that I wanted to do all this meaningful, deep drama and all this other work. And all that's fine, you know, if it comes along and it's a good story and kind of okay, I'll do it. But people need to be entertained. You know, there's so much stuff going on, and there's so much strife, and people are struggling to do this, that, or the other in their lives, that I hope that when people come to a film, I mean, they leave, they have something to smile about, something to laugh about, and say that was a good time.
But you say about popcorn movies, and of course, big entertaining movies, they're a spectacle these days, but you can also have meaningful movies which are thoroughly entertaining. The early films, you may be Spike Lee, examples of that. I mean, those movies really, they, you know, they had a lot to say, but they were also really entertaining, really enthralling.
Yeah. Yeah, and Spike still makes those kind of movies.
Yeah.
I still work with Spike. He just directs my commercials.
But would you make a movie again with him?
I did a movie with Spike a couple of years ago. I did two movies. I've done two movies.
What was
since.
The last one? Was it Old Boy?
Last one was, I think Chirac was before Old Boy.
Oh, yeah, Chirac was after Old Boy.
Chirac was after Old Boy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The Marvel movies have been amazing, especially as, you know, I grew up with Nick Fury, and Nick Fury was a white guy.
Yeah, he's a white guy.
And suddenly we
he
got
was
the
David Hasselhoff for a while.
Yeah.
David Hasselhoff did it.
I mean, we love David Hasselhoff,
yeah.
But it didn't really, the movie around him wasn't quite right. Should we put it that way?
Okay.
Yeah. But you are now Fury to this whole generation.
Well, thanks to Mark Miller.
Well, Mark Millar, and we've got to say this, Brian Hitch, the artist who drew the Ultimates. Because the way I hear it is, he's the guy who drew you there first. And then Mark said, yeah, so you've been giving Mark all these props.
I have, yeah.
It's Brian Hitch.
Oh.
You want to give a big thank you to Brian Hitch right there?
Okay, yes, I will.
Okay, thank you. Right. I'll pass it on to him. He's a sweet guy.
Yeah.
But that's been an amazing development. And those movies, I guess you're talking about being a cog in a machine. I imagine that's a huge machine around you there.
It is. When I first got the job and they said, okay, it's a 9-picture obligation, I go, how long am I going to stay alive to do 9 movies?
Yes.
Yeah, not knowing that they were going to make, you know, 9 movies in like 15 days. They've accomplished it. I've worn that contract out and continued. And then Nick Fury is one of those characters that audiences do ask about. You know, when he's not around. It's kind of like, well, where was Nick Fury when that was going on? And when they were having the Civil War, it's like when they're arguing amongst themselves, it's like, where's their, you know, foster father?
Where
to send him to their room.
He's the top man.
Yeah.
So presumably, have you signed another big deal with Marvel? Have you agreed a set number of new movies? Or
no, I have not.
So you kind of got them where you want them?
I'm kind of, like I said, a gunslinger in that frontier of the Marvel frontier.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gun for hire.
Yeah, they're amazing fun to watch. And you like watching yourself on screen, don't you?
I do.
Yeah, which is quite unusual for... I know, I think secretly all actors love that.
I believe that.
Yeah, but a lot of them don't admit it.
Yeah, they say that because it makes them sound like, I'm not full of myself. Come on, dude. I enjoy watching myself.
And which film have you
most... And if you truly don't enjoy watching yourself, you shouldn't expect people to pay their money to watch you.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
What's the film you've most enjoyed seeing yourself in, and what's the film you've least enjoyed seeing yourself in?
My favorite film out of all the films I think, you know, I've done up until now was A Long Kiss Goodnight.
I love that film. Rennie
Harlin. I had such a great time with Gina Davis, yeah.
And they killed you off initially in that film, didn't
they? They did, yeah. And then they tested the movie, and the audience was like, no, you can't kill me.
People spoke.
Yeah.
That must be a nice feeling.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. You mentioned when you were offered the 9-picture S.H.I.E.L.D. deal or Fury deal with Marvel, how many movies can I make? So you're 70 now. Are you troubled by thoughts like that about how much longer I got? Does that concern you? Have you come to terms with that sense of mortality?
Yeah, you get up every day and you do what you can when you get up. You know, if I don't get up one day, then I don't have to worry about going to a movie set.
Yeah.
Until then, you know. What I'm trying to do.
And do you work out?
I do Pilates, yeah, twice a week.
I didn't mean to look down at you then. I wasn't
trying to assess. No, it's fine. Pilates twice a week.
Yeah, you're looking good on it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got to start doing that. How does your wife cope with you being away so much? Is she cool with that? I mean, she must be after all these years, but how do you balance that?
It was kind of who we thought we were going to be all along, you know. Back when we were in college and we started doing theater, we understood the nature of, you know, having to be in one place. There were times when we both were working in New York, but most times... One or the other of us was on the road doing a show while the other one was there in New York taking care of the kid. So it's always been that way. And, you know, just always a way to meet on a common ground somewhere, you know. So,
do you like it if she's there with you when you're filming, or do you prefer not to have, you know, an emotional attachment nearby?
Doesn't bother me either way. I've done all the homework, you know, before I show up to go to work. I know what I want to do, so I don't have to sit at home and rehearse at night, and I don't run lines with her.
Yeah.
She's like, do you want me to run lines with you? No. Of course not.
Oh, so she offers?
Yeah.
And you decline?
I've already done it. You know, yeah. I know it.
But you are super pro like that, aren't you? I know, because I'm a friend with Matthew Vaughn, of course, who did you in the Kingsman movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he said very rarely has he worked with someone who turned up ready to go every day.
Yeah.
So I guess that's that would account to an extent to your longevity and your success.
Well, that's part of it, but it's part of his job too, being prepared. When I first started doing theater, one of the things the director of the department, you know, when I was studying, I was like, okay, if I say rehearsals at 7 o'clock, that doesn't mean you show up at 7 o'clock. So when I say rehearsals at 7 o'clock, at 7 o'clock, you're in place, ready to go.
So you arrive late at 6:45. You're good to go then.
Yeah.
And so you learned that. But I guess, now how do you deal if you're working with a young actor who doesn't? Do you ever get involved, or you just leave it for the director? You ever take them to one side and give them that advice?
I have. It's part of your job. It's your job is to be here and be ready to go when it's time to go.
Yeah.
Or your job is to know your lines. I mean, excuse me.
He's pretty basic.
That's what they pay you to do. You know, you only got one job. Learn your lines, hit your mark, you know.
Sam, have you worked with people who didn't know their lines?
Yes.
That's excruciating.
There's that, you know, and there, you know, I don't know what it is or why, but I mean, I didn't meet an actor that hadn't done theater until I got to LA.
Right.
You know, and the actors go, how do you learn all those lines?
Yeah.
What do you mean? We're only doing like a page and a half.
Yeah.
I used to do something that you had to do from beginning to end every night that might be 3 hours long. So it's called theater.
Do you miss doing theater?
I do sometimes. When I'm in New York, I miss it because I go to plays.
Well, you played, didn't you play Dr. King?
I did a couple of years ago in Mountaintop.
Yeah, yeah. And so you would go back maybe if it was the right part, I guess.
Right thing, yeah, right play. Yeah.
I was thinking of Spike a minute ago because I was thinking we haven't talked about Quentin.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in a way, Quentin, I mean, Spike was hugely important in your career.
Mm-hmm.
And then Quentin really, your collaboration with him took it to the next level. And yet you seem to be kind of in between the middle of Spike and Quentin who have these disagreements.
Mm-hmm.
You still there?
I don't know. I don't know that they still have them. I don't know what their relationship is at this
Spike
point.
Spike told me. Yeah.
Oh, did he?
Spike told
recently?
Me.
Recently?
Yeah.
They're still beefing?
Recently.
Oh, I don't know anything about that.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're not dragged into it. You're not like the kind, they're not possessive of you. And it's like, hey, Sam,
no.
Quentin's still doing this. And Spike,
no, not at all.
Okay.
No.
That's a good place to be
that's
then.
Not my. No.
And you're keen that we can cut this bit out so we don't even stir any of that up again.
Yeah, no, it's fine. Yeah. No, I have no idea what's going on.
When was the last time you saw Quentin? Your last movie together was Hateful Eight.
Last time I saw Quentin was his engagement party.
Wow.
Almost a year and a half, 2 years ago.
What's he doing next? Are you working with him again? Do you have
no, he's plans? Finished that movie that he did with Leo and Brad Pitt.
This is the Manson film.
Whatever that is. Yeah, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Presumably you'd work with him again.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because Jackie Brown, I thought, was one of your finest performances.
I love Jackie Brown.
Yeah, it's an amazing film. Yeah. It's the most underrated of his films, I feel.
I think so, yeah. It's one of those films. It's kind of like Unbreakable was for Knight, because it came right after Sixth Sense.
Yeah.
And Sixth Sense made all his money, and all of a sudden, you know, he's doing his next film, which in my mind was successful, but it didn't make the kind of money that, you know, Sixth Sense made. So Jackie Brown coming on the heels of Pulp Fiction, like, yes, a great film, but not Pulp Fiction.
Oh, yeah,
it wasn't
flashy in that way either.
It's a movie about different things.
Yeah.
You know, it's about grown people making grown decisions.
You know,
people at the crossroads of their lives, and it's a slower, it's a more cerebral film.
Yeah, it's a beautiful film, I think.
Yeah.
It's a really wonderful film. Pulp Fiction, you must have known, I guess, when you read the script. I know no one knows anything in advance, but you must have known, okay, there's a very good chance this is going to be big.
I had no idea it was going to be big. I knew that I had friends that would like it. I like quirky movies, and it was very quirky on the page. And I thought, exciting. If, you know, the powers that be let us shoot what's on the page, this is going to be an interesting movie for a certain age group. I didn't know it would cross, you know, the lines that it crossed.
I mean, it's one of those movies which will survive. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, it's got that power to it.
It's withstood the test of time. Like, yeah. I said in this article, you know, I mean, every year I end up with, you know, 5-6 million new fans because a group of kids become of age that it's okay for them to watch it. And they watch it and go, my God, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen.
And he's the coolest character in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we can both tell Bruce Willis that to his face.
Yeah.
He knows it.
No problem.
You know, we touched very briefly on race and issues of race in America now. And I'm hoping it does seem to me like, in terms of representation on screen and diversity behind the camera, with the success of Get Out last year, and Black Panther, which was an important milestone, I think, in cinema. That must be heartening for someone who was involved in civil rights back then to see these changes happening in the industry where you've made your home now, albeit perhaps a bit overdue. It must be quite an exciting thing to witness.
Well, it's very exciting to see all the different kinds of things. I mean, the fact that there are so many platforms means that, you know, there's a market for all kinds of stuff. So there's you know, the woman's market, there's films for the LGBTQ community, you know, that are, you know, part and parcel of it, television shows. I mean, all these things, Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, Google, Apple, along with mainstream cinema and all these
Which
other things, and not just independent
well,
film is, you know,
yeah.
There is still some indie film.
Yeah.
And Sundance is still Sundance, but it's way more corporate than it used to be. So there's all kinds of places and all kinds of stories that people are having the opportunity to tell because they need to fill these platforms, along with, you know, people doing their own little Amazon series and podcasts and all these other things. I mean, people are finding ways to artistically get their message out there in a lot of different platforms. And it's wonderful to see. You know, it's like I was asking my daughter about Crazy Rich Asians because I finally saw it. You know, it's kind of like, That was like Black Panther for that. You know,
and it's a lovely, joyous movie, like an old school.
Awesome.
Yeah,
amazing film. It was great fun. So, yes, there's an appetite, and there are young filmmakers telling stories that haven't been told before that appeal to a specific audience that end up reaching a wider audience.
But it's been interesting because I remember years ago, I went out and I interviewed Jackie Chan in Hong Kong. It was the first kind of Western big interview done for a TV show because I was a huge fan.
Did you go to his Nobu?
I didn't go to – this was before he had the Nobu. This was like 88.
Okay.
Way back when, and I remember talking to one of the directors out there, because I loved Hong Kong cinema, and I said, why are these movies – because the action films were much crisper, the way they were directed and put together, much more exciting than most American movies, maybe apart from Die Hard, which John Tiernan did that great job with. So why don't they show these in America? And he said, because they won't go to see – an American audience won't go to see Asian faces on screen.
That's not true.
That was the perception back then, though. Yeah. So it's interesting that – but that was – it's taken 30 years, it seems, for them to really come around to that. And to prove the case, don't you think?
For me, see, I've always gone to, I've watched Shaw Brothers films forever.
You and me both, but I'm saying in terms of mainstream.
Depends on what you call mainstream. It's like in New York in the mid to late 70s, there were actually two theaters on 42nd Street that screened Hong Kong films.
I know.
You see three movies for a dollar.
Wow.
And I would go to those when I was waiting to go to the theater at night. I spend my time in the Hong Kong films all day long. And you could buy videotapes like three for $15. So I brought a lot of Shaw Brothers movies, you know, Seven Chambers and all those different things.
Seven Chambers of Shaolin.
Yeah, of course.
First time I went to New York, it was still there, the 42nd Street, the old 42nd Street.
Old 42nd
before
Street.
It was
porno and kung fu.
Amazing place.
Yeah, it was awesome.
I got straight off the boat because I went over on it and I went straight to see a double bill, kung fu double bill.
Mm-hmm.
When Taekwondo Strikes. another one, amazing experience. That's all gone now. Yeah. You must be nostalgic for that. I know it's kind of nice that New York isn't grimy and sleazy in its center.
Yeah, 42nd Street's family oriented now.
There's a romantic attachment to the old place, isn't there?
Yeah, but you still hear that, you know, da, 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 and the gong.
You know it's coming.
The Shaw Brothers. It's going to be awesome. But I've always been tuned into Asian cinema in that way.
But what I was saying, Sam, I wasn't picking up on saying that they didn't exist and there wasn't an audience for it.
Saying
the until New Line came along, there was no one putting them out there, and they put out Crippled Masters, which was a movie that they're now embarrassed to admit they had, even though I consider it a fine film.
Yeah, we'll see, but that was the highbrow too. You know, John Woo all of a sudden became the highbrow Asian cinema. So you had Chow Yun-Fat being the biggest star in the world and the most handsome dude on the planet.
Yeah.
You know, and he was what I guess people refer to me now. He was the coolest dude on the planet at the time when The Killer was out and, you know, Hard Boiled and all those
things. Amazing films.
Oh, awesome films. You know, he was just, people were like, that's who I want.
But what I'm saying, it has changed though, hasn't it?
Yes.
Which is exciting. How do we ensure it doesn't change back? Because there was movement before, as you said. 68 onwards, civil rights movement, gradual change occurred. Change occurred in society, swept away. Now we
Art is different from all that other stuff. I mean, the politics of race and all those things are one thing. Art has reached a point where we can tell our stories and we can do all those things. And yes, they're not going to be popular among everyone. Everyone's not going to go and see them. But specific people who do go and see them will continue to go and see them. And young people who see those things will continue to reflect their world as they see them, as they become young filmmakers, which is what happened. Films and television shows became populated with different kinds of people because they grew up with different kinds of people. You grew up as a kid, you might have an Asian doctor. You might have, you know, an African lawyer. You may have people, the grocery store that you go to may be populated by people from somewhere else. So as those people make films and tell their stories, they tell stories that look like the world that they grew up in. And there are people who still live in those isolated pockets of whiteness or whatever it is that they live in, and they don't see those people, and their world is a lot narrower than the worlds that we live in or experience.
But it is an exciting time.
Always.
I can't wait to hear. One final thing. Are we gonna see Fury appearing in Wakanda? Is he gonna go and
I keep asking them that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a natural fit.
How can Nick Fury not show up in Wakanda?
I know.
Yeah.
How did they invite him over?
Exactly. That's why I said at least I could have been in Korea in the casino when they showed up.
No plans?
Not yet.
Sam, great to see you again. Thank you so much for giving us the time.
All right.
I can't wait to see you.
Well, hopefully I'll see you hopefully when we come back for Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
We can hang out again.
Yeah.
What do we call you, sir?
First name, Mister. Last name, Glass.
Samuel L. Jackson, one of the great 70 and still going strong. And Glass, the movie we were talking about at the beginning of that interview, is out everywhere now. And if you liked Unbreakable and you like Split, then you need to go and see this just to see what they were both leading up to. On next week's podcast, I'll be talking to the director of Glass, M. Night Shyamalan, who's also made Unbreakable, of course, and Split. But before that, The Sixth Sense with his big movie, Signs, what I thought was a very impressive piece of work, and more recently, the low-budget horror film, The Visit. So download that one as well if you can. And if you haven't already subscribed, please do and spread the word, because we like doing this and we hope you like listening.